The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hi, it's Glenn Beck, and it's that time of year when the housing market starts to pick up steam. So if you have been thinking about selling your home, please know a couple of things. Interest rates are going up. They're going to rise the rest of the year. If you need to sell or you're thinking about it, right now is the time to list your home with realestateagentsitrust.com. I started realestateagentsitrust.com because I knew there had to be a better way to sell or buy a home. And with the market average for selling cycle of 6 to 9 months, you need to get a jump on the rest of the market. Competition is going to be stiff this year, but with realestateagentsitrust.com, my team has assembled the agents who I trust, who you can trust, who will get the most money for your home as quickly as possible. At realestateagentsitrust.com, we've taken the guesswork and anxiety out of selling your home. So put them to work for you now. Realestateagentsitrust.com. Realestateagentsitrust.com.
Realestateagentsitrust.com is a Mercury Real Estate LLC.
Glenn Beck.
It's All Hallows Eve. It's upon us now. And there is a terror more frightening than anything that has ever been unleashed on our streets. Just lurking. It's around the corner. What if I were to tell you that 31% of the population has been infected with this terror? Over 100 million Americans are out to get you. How will you ever know which one you can trust? Well, I'm here to tell you, you can't trust any of them. 100 million, for crying out loud, 100 million, they're coming to get you. Now, who will shed light on this? Who is it that will open our fingers because we're too afraid to look at the monster? We're too afraid to look at the monster and identify it. Well, Don Lemon is that man.
So we have to stop demonizing people and realize the biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right, to the right. And we have to start doing something about them. There is no travel ban on them.
Oh, my gosh.
There is no ban on, you know, they had the Muslim ban. There is no white guy ban.
Oh, my gosh.
So what do we do about that?
We need a white man ban. Okay? We need a ban on white men. I love this. Could we just play this again? We have to stop demonizing and recognize it's not period. We have to stop demonizing. It's we have to stop demonizing and recognize. Listen to the beginning of this again.
So we have to stop demonizing people and realize the biggest terror threat in this country is white men.
Okay, most of them most of them on the right too. I don't know if you've noticed this, but white men are literally everywhere, and there's no travel ban. Please, if you haven't left the house yet, have you checked your children, especially if you have a white male in the house? Have you checked your children? Black people who are friends with white people, can you please call the white wife and make sure she hasn't been knifed by her white husband? They're all radicals. The biggest terror threat is white men. We should cancel Halloween. I don't know how we can even do this. Are we going to have people just roaming the streets? Have you seen the latest Halloween? Have you seen it? Jason, a white man, just walking the streets, going up and ding dong, trick or treat. He goes in the back door. He's a white man. He just kills people.
I know it's really confusing because it's, you know, there's so many white men that are terrorists, the leading terrorist threat, but it's actually Michael Myers in Halloween.
Oh, is
Jason's
it?
Friday the 13th.
Okay.
He's another white
man. Another
murderer.
White man, though. See? Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine if all the white men disguised as middle-aged accountants that have just lived their life and never bothered anybody. You're just going to let your little kids go up to that house and get candy? We are screwed, man. Don Lemon, God bless him, has gone nuts. He has. There's a few people that have really, truly lost it, and they're not even listening to themselves anymore. It's amazing. First of all, one of the most contradictory things I've ever heard. Let me quote again. So we have to stop demonizing people and realize the biggest terror threat in this country is white men. Don, you're demonizing white men. He went from zero, stop demonizing, basically don't be racist, to 100. White men are scary. We need a white man ban. It's the most demonizing, racist thing I've heard. Can I ask you, what is the definition of racism, Stu? What is the definition? Isn't it saying all people are have this trait if they're part of this race?
Yeah, discrimination, antagonism, prejudice directed against someone of a different race based on the belief that one's own race is superior. The belief that all members of each race possess characteristics or abilities specific to that race, especially as to distinguish it as inferior or superior to another race.
Okay, so that would be it. White men are the problem. I've never said that about Islam. All of the people who are Muslim are the problem. It would be wrong to say that. White men are the problem. We're also eager to assign blame. How many of us were rapidly refreshing social media, hoping like hell that the faux pipe bomber was someone from the left? Why? Why? Everyone on the left was doing the same thing, except in reverse. We're doing it because we want someone to point to and say, get them. We want somebody to blame. See, it's them. We're not addressing the actual issues here. White men are the problem? Really? I'm so sick and tired of hearing what we did in the 1800s. Do you know the Trail of Tears? Yes, I know the Trail of Tears. It was awful. You know who did it? Democratic President Jackson. A despicable human being. He took our founding principles and turned them upside down. That's not an American thing to do. That's all you talk about. Well, I got it. How about we talk about the Japanese and Unit 731? Worse than the Nazis. Now that's saying something. Worse than the Nazis. They went in and they said the only problem with Mongolia is all these Mongols. Tried to kill them all. They just stormed into China. Where was the white man there? Speaking of China, how about Mao? 50 million dead. Was he led by a white man? North Korea. Concentration camps. Where's the white guy? Rwanda. Where's the white guy there? You see, Don, it is not a race problem. It is a human problem. But nobody really wants to talk about that because nobody's really looking for an answer. Good God Almighty, can we decide if we want to save this or not? Do you want to save it? No one wants to discuss mental health. No one wants to discuss addiction to drugs, loneliness, disconnection from community, the decline of religion. The list goes on and on and on. It's all about yes, but which party did you vote for? It's easy to see why you hear, you know, when you hear people like Don Lemon spew this, and this is Don hate. Spew this hate that CNN actually has the gall to call objective reporting. And to the over 100 million white men out there, you can forget switching to Geico. You've just saved tons of money by never having to buy a Halloween costume ever again because you're the biggest terror threat in the country. Just show up in your golf pants. Oh, because I know what you want to do with that golf club. You just want to beat people to death.
It's Wednesday, October 31st. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Okay, can I... May I just... read a great Washington Post editorial. After a deranged Democrat living in his van nearly assassinated Republican Steve Scalise, firing more than 70 rounds at House Republicans practicing for the congressional baseball game, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi declared it outrageous that anyone would blame Democratic rhetoric for inspiring the shooter. Quote, "How dare they say such a thing?" Pelosi thundered. Never mind that the shooter echoed Democratic vitriol against the president, ranting on Facebook that Trump is guilty and should go to prison for treason, and that, quote, Trump has destroyed our democracy. It's time to destroy Trump and company. Now, Democrats are doing exactly what they condemned. Man, it is so easy. Doesn't it feel good, Stu, to get up in the morning and know that I don't have to answer for my positions in the past, because I've been consistent? I didn't blame the Democrats for that shooting. I'm not blaming Donald Trump for this.
Yeah, feels good.
Feels really good. Democrats are doing exactly what they condemn, blaming President Trump's divisive rhetoric for the recent spat of mail bomb attacks and the massacre at Pittsburgh Synagogue. The truth is, they ceded the moral high ground years ago. Our descent into vitriol began long before Trump. And Democrats and their allies are as culpable as the president. Notice he even said this. They're as culpable. He didn't say they're responsible. It's their fault. Finally, somebody with reason is saying, yeah, both sides. Recall that in 2000, the NAACP spent millions on ugly ads accusing George W. Bush of moral equivalence with white supremacists who brutally lynched James Byrd in 1998. Quote, "My father was beaten, chained, and then dragged 3 miles to his death, all because he was black," said Byrd's daughter, as the screen flashed grainy images of a chain dragging a body behind a pickup truck. "So when Governor George W. Bush refused to support hate crime legislation, it was like my father was killed all over again." Was that the Republicans doing that? Are you demonizing? Could you look up demonizing? I just want to make sure. It's assigning characteristics of the devil. No. Barack Obama set the tone for his 2008 campaign against John McCain when he declared, "If they bring a knife to the fight, we bring a gun." John Lewis, Democrat from Georgia, answered that call when he compared McCain to the segregationist Alabama's Governor George Wallace, and declared McCain was replicating the climate of hatred and division. John frickin' McCain. That led to the attacks on civil rights workers. 4 years later, a pro-Obama super PAC ran ads showing GOP vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan pushing an old lady in a wheelchair over the side of a cliff, while another ran a false ad blaming Mitt Romney for a woman's death from cancer. Can we just all agree on this? Because I was not a supporter of Mitt Romney. His policies are all screwed up. However, Mitt Romney is a good guy. He's a nice guy. How do you demonize Mitt Romney? They did. And when the left was honest for about 5 minutes after they got beaten by Donald Trump, I heard one of them say, "You know what? We kind of brought this on ourselves because we rejected and demonized people like Mitt Romney." Yes. Yes. You're exactly right. During the 2016 campaign, Hillary Clinton compared Republicans to Nazis, saying regard to illegal immigrants, they wanted to round them up and put them into boxcars. So let's see. Let's see. Let's see. Demonizing. We got to stop with this rhetoric. Putting them into boxcars. You're saying that Donald Trump is going to round people up and put them into camps like Auschwitz? She compared the GOP to terrorists, just what Don Lemon did today. Now extreme views on women. We expect that from some of the terrorist groups. We expect that from people who don't want to live in a modern world, but it's a little hard to take from the Republicans. She listed the Republicans alongside the Iranians as the enemies she was most proud of making. So press, don't tell me about Donald Trump calling you an enemy. Unless you're also going to point out that maybe the other side should stop as well, because they both should stop. Oh, I am not doing any good here. I just don't know what. I don't know how to do my job anymore. When Trump took office, Democrats abandoned their role as opposition and declared themselves the resistance. Look up the word resistance. In the Oxford Dictionary, you'll see the definition. The use of force or violence to oppose someone or something. Professor of Political Science at University of Indiana notes the word resistance, quote, first surfaces in debates about tyrannicide, the violent removal from power of misbehaving kings who usurp authority not properly belonging to them. Scalise would have been forgiven for pointing out that his would-be assassin took Democrats' calls to resistance literally. More recently, some Democrats were peddling the unfounded accusations that Brett Kavanaugh participated in gang rapes in an effort to destroy the Supreme Court nominee. Clinton defended smash-mouth tactics, declaring you can't be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for. Well, I got to ask you this. What is it we stand for? Hillary, what is it you stand for? And don't use your fancy little political, all your focus group words. What does the Democratic Party stand for? And if you use their focus group, well, equality, justice, and fairness. But what does that mean? Redistribution of wealth. Redistribution of power. Forcibly. What does the Republican Party stand for? I don't know. I can tell you what I stand for. I can tell you what I think the vast majority of Americans stand for. All men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That you have a right to freedom of speech. That nobody should be able to shut down the press. That you have a right to assemble with whoever it is you want to assemble with. You have a right to petition your government. You have a right to protect yourself. The government can't come in and just say, oh yeah, by the way, we're just going to live here. The government can't come in and tap your phones, go through your papers. You can't be forced to testify against yourself. There's no cruel and unusual punishment. There's a lot more. But those rights that we're not naming, they belong to the individual. And there's some other powers, too, that those things belong to the state. That's the Bill of Rights. That's what we have in common. That's what we should stand for. That's what will bring us back together. But no one wants to talk about that because that's a solution. That's a solution. You know, when we started this country, we had a group of people in Congress that wanted a solution. We don't have that now. We don't have that. And we are growing further and further apart to where the people aren't even looking for a solution anymore. Well, once you've gotten to that point, you're done. You're done. Now, who wants to say, let's look for a solution because this is worth saving? Sponsor this half hour is X Chair. X Chair is a chair that you're going to say, I love my office chair. We have X chairs in the studios, and there's, I don't even know, like 400 different ways you can adjust this thing. It actually, it conforms to your body. And you can adjust it six ways to Sunday. It is really, really comfortable. We spend most of our day in our office chair. And I will tell you this, stop buying it from Staples. Go get yourself an office chair, office chair, and you will see the difference. Get an X chair now at 844-4X-CHAIR, or you just go to xchairbeck.com. Look at these things, and then sitting in one is believing. Just have them send one out to you with 30-day, no questions asked, guarantee, complete satisfaction. You don't love it, not the best office chair you've ever sat in, return it. But get it now. B-E-C-K is the promo code at xchairbeck.com or 844-4X-CHAIR, xchairbeck.com. So I just want to let you know that the environmentalists have a plan for you to save the environment. I'm not kidding you. That is why we have to kill our pets. Okay, all right. But let's worry about free-range chicken. But kill your dog, man. Kill your dog. It's killing the environment. We'll give you that and so much more. It's Halloween on the Glenn Beck Program. Welcome to Halloween. It's the Glenn Beck Program. We're glad you're here. Pat Gray is joining us now. Pat, I don't know if you've seen the latest, but the environmentalists who, you know, they care about, you know, they care about the animals. They care about the planet. They care about everything. They believe we should kill our pets now because we have this compulsion to seek out animal companionship. It is one of our primary factors affecting our climate, particularly in the United States, where there are 163 million companion animals, roughly one pet for every two Americans, the highest number of any country in the world. And those 163 million pets have a detrimental impact on the environment, from the food they consume to the waste they produce. So the best thing we can do is kill our pets.
Euthanize every one of our pets.
I don't know about you, but I care about the planet. I'm willing to euthanize all the cats.
I'm willing to get rid of all of them. Yes.
All of the cats. Get rid of all
just
the cats,
though.
Cats. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
You seem to be a bit anti-cat. That's why I'm just asking.
Well, did you see also that the cats are responsible for killing over a billion birds a year?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, they're bad for the environment, too.
6 billion small animals.
Yeah.
But a billion birds specifically. And for the extinction of many bird species.
No, there was a news story out that talked about the predator that is in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a cat. And they are killing birds and billions of animals.
Mm-hmm.
Billions of animals. And we have to euthanize the cats. And I'm willing to go there.
I am too, because first of all, I've got a theory about cat owners, and I
do too.
If you have one, you're worth monitoring. Okay, we should monitor
you. I think you can have one, but your family should notice.
Yes.
Yes. I don't want you monitored.
For two, you start monitoring.
Yes. Two, you should have to register at the school.
Mm-hmm.
You should have to, you should have to register with maybe local law enforcement. We should just know where you are.
Yeah, at all times.
At all times.
At all times. Yeah. If you have three, you got to be institutionalized.
Oh, really?
Yeah, institutionalized.
I think more than three is when you need to be destroyed at some way. I don't. Why spend the money on institutionalization?
Yes,
institutionalization.
Right.
We know you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to go.
Well, you're going to wind up dead, and the cats are going to eat you anyway.
Yeah. So I mean, and we might as well just
you avoid all that.
Yeah. But I think you're right. Cat people are disturbing. They really are.
Now, disturbing.
Can you do all this with executive order, or do you need to get legislation?
No, this is perfectly fine from an executive order.
Yeah.
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 So Trump can just do this
today.
Sure,
he wants to.
Okay. Sure,
he's got the power.
Just like he can with the executive order on the border. Constitution. Yeah, executive order.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is compelling.
You, where do you stand on that executive order, Pat?
We heard this from Pat yesterday.
Yeah,
same places yesterday.
So we talked about this yesterday after we spoke, and there's a pretty good case made by originalists
that say, no, 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 birthright anchor babies. That's what they meant, and that's right.
It's interesting that there's two sides of it among people.
Among conservatives,
which is why these are the types of issues I find most interesting.
Yeah. What is the case for?
So let me give you a little piece of it here. I'll tweet this out at World of Stew as well if you want to read the whole thing.
You will dismantle it quickly because I did. But it's interesting that it's coming from a conservative originalist.
You felt that you dismantled this quickly?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You don't feel like he did?
Yeah.
Well, no,
I'll give you my case.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
James Madison said it is an established maxim that there is that birth is a criterion of allegiance. Birth, however, derives its force sometimes from place and sometimes from parentage. But in general, place is the most certain criterion. It is what applies in the United States. It will therefore be unnecessary to investigate any other. This goes on to then quote, this is Edward Bates, President Lincoln's Attorney General.
Wait. Can we separate these two? Mm-hmm. Because the first one is James Madison. Hard to take it apart because it's James Madison, right?
Yeah.
However, James Madison, I think in this particular case, James Madison is looking at something different.
He's looking at whether you came from Great Britain or not.
Correct. He's not talking about people who are coming in trying to drop off to be able to take stuff or bring the whole family
in.
Were
you born in the colonies or were you born in Great Britain?
Correct. And they answered that two ways. If you were born here, you don't need naturalization. However, you also have to be born here to be president. And that's what they were worried about. They were worried about these English coming in. Try this out for size. They were worried about the English coming in and just saying, hey, I'm American. I'm living here and I'm American, so I can vote. Because they knew that if all these English people came in, they would change the country. That's why they didn't want a foreigner as president as well. You had to be born here. So they were trying to protect it at that time from the English coming in and screwing up the country with a vote, which is what we're dealing with now.
I think I agree with that, although he's saying if you're born here, you do have
correct
rights.
Because it was a different time and a different problem.
Yep.
And I say, like, as much as I love James Madison, I love the founders, it's almost less important what they thought about this particular issue because it was an amendment to the Constitution, right? We're talking about the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
They do.
And that's why you have to separate James Madison because that's not constitutional. He didn't put that in the Constitution. Well, that was put in under Lincoln. And so now go to that because that's a different argument as well.
So this is now Edward Bates is President Lincoln's Attorney General. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're in a pretty, this is again a few years right before they do the 14th Amendment. It incorporates the language and is, this is from the article from National Review, properly understood to have codified Attorney General Bates' contemporary understanding. This is what he says. I am quite clear in the opinion that children born in the United States of alien parents who have never been naturalized are native-born citizens of the United States and, of course, do not require the formality of naturalization to entitle them to the rights and privileges of such citizenship.
Isn't there more?
That is the end of that quote.
I thought there was something else, too, about, or maybe it was in James Madison, that they had come in the proper way or something. I thought I heard that earlier today. But the Abraham Lincoln thing is just the same. Remember,
wasn't a constitutional thing because there wasn't a 14th Amendment yet.
I know, but he's writing it. This is the beginning of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first one is, how do we know who a citizen is? Because it's almost all, well, it is at that point, all immigrants, except those who had come over in the Mayflower or had their relatives come over before him. So it's a very small number. It was mainly immigrants. So how do you know who is an American? Well, were you born here? That was the question of who's an American at that time, because it was mainly, people from England, and they were worried about the English coming in. So you're born here, you're a citizen, you can serve, you can vote.
Starting to get a pretty serious German influx, too.
Yes, serious German, and they were freaked by that. The second thing is with Lincoln, he's trying to solve a different problem. He's trying to solve at that point
the Democrat, literally the Democratic Party. This is their first attempt before poll taxes and, you know, moving the polling place and all of the crap that they did. The first thing was, oh, well, you know, you're not OK. You might be a citizen, but your kids weren't slaves. So your kids aren't citizens. They're trying to say, stop it. Stop it. We're talking about the slaves. The slaves are free. They're citizens. And so are their children. That you have to look at the 13th and 14th Amendment for what it was talking about and what it was trying to do. It was trying to say to the Democrats, stop it. These are human beings and they are citizens.
I'd be fascinated to hear these two sides talk this out, because they're both coming from the conservative perspective. It's not like, you know, Chris Cuomo versus somebody you trust, right? These are both sides of the argument. Yeah. I think are really, they're interesting. Because I think you're right, but sometimes that is, because that is definitely what they were intending, right? It was about slavery. However, sometimes intended consequences where you would absorb a larger group to make sure one group is
there is no safe. Way the intent is that if you come here from Mexico, Central or South America and you have a baby and everybody who does that is now a citizen.
There are
Russian tours now that take you take you to Miami. The Russians go to Miami. You stay here for a few weeks. You have the baby here. Your child has American citizenship. Same thing in Hawaii with the Asians. Yeah. It's big in Hawaii, but probably also big in California. That's not what they were talking about. This
not
is
at
a
all.
Different problem.
Yeah.
The Constitution, the first 10 in the Bill of Rights, those are universal. Those are gigantic. So when somebody says, it's in the Bill of Rights, well, is it in the first 10? Because the first 10 are global. Pretty much, with an exception of new ideas, pretty much the rest of them are a restating of the first one, where they had to get very specific and say, no, dummy, women are part of, all men are created equal. Women can vote. Same thing with blacks in the 13th and 14th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
They were specific, where the amendments are very broad, the first 10.
Would it have made sense for them to think that in Dallas, Texas, United States of America, at Parkland Hospital, 75% of the babies born there are born to illegals, and now they're all citizens?
No.
That doesn't make sense to anybody. That doesn't.
No, I definitely don't think it's
ridiculous.
A good idea. Right?
It's not a good idea.
The Constitution, this is the best phrase, and I can't understand how people don't understand this. The Constitution was not meant to be a suicide pact.
That's Posner, right? But that's also a very dangerous phrase. Like I feel like that's the same argument people use with the Second Amendment. Oh well, they look. I mean, at the time, they only had these little weapons, and they wanted freedom of guns. I mean, these guns are too big and too brutal, and this is not meant to be a suicide pact.
No, when I'm talking about suicide pact, I mean on the principles. On the principles, it's not meant to be a suicide pact. If we follow these principles, you won't have a constitution. You won't have America anymore. You just won't, because
we've been doing it for 100 years, and we still have America.
Right? We're doing it differently now. There was not the have a baby tourism back in 1900.
No, I mean, it's certainly being exploited at some levels,
yes.
Right? I mean, but that does not mean argument is an argument to amend the Constitution, right? Like,
yes.
Let's just say if their intent was at the beginning, let's just say it was that we want aliens to just come in and have and drop babies over here, and they're going to be anchor babies and they're going to get citizenship. Let's just say that was their intent. I don't think it was, but let's just say it was. If that was true, and back then people weren't exploiting it, and now people are,
you'd
that's
have
an
to
argument
amend the
to amend the Constitution, not to just say we now think you
that's
can't do
that's the problem.
It.
If you want to change guns, don't make some slippery argument.
Yeah, just amend it.
18th Amendment, 21st Amendment. Mm-hmm. We said, you know what? We're going to ban all alcohol. We did it. Bad idea. 21st Amendment, forget the 18th Amendment. We need a drink.
Okay? Right, yeah, and that's okay.
That's the way you're supposed to do it.
Yeah.
And they don't want to do it that way because
it's hard.
It's hard, and they know that it's impossible to make the argument because when you do something that big, you actually have to think about it.
And that's why the president's not suggesting we have a constitutional amendment. He's suggesting an executive order.
Right. And that's
which would be overturned immediately.
Immediately. All right.
Pat Gray Unleashed on Blaze Radio and TV networks every single day. Also, Pat on the News and Why It Matters as well. You can listen and watch those on the Blaze Radio and TV networks and get anywhere you get your podcasts.
So what do you do when emergency strikes? What's your first impulse? Right? Panic. Run for your life. Well, okay, that's maybe your first impulse, but not your best impulse. What you need to do is, do you have a way to be prepared? I think of wildfires and hurricanes all the time. I don't know how people have afforded these hurricanes. I mean, it could wipe you out. Just living in a hotel and having to go to dinner every night with your family, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. How are people affording this? This is crazy. My Patriot Supply has food storage, and it's grab-and-go stuff. Now, here's what they have right now. If you go to preparewithglenn.com, $75 will get you a two-week food kit. Breakfast, lunch, dinner comes in a rugged tote, so you can, you know, put this in your closet, or you can put this in your trunk of your car or under your bed. Something happens, you grab, you go. You have 2 weeks of food for $75. Call 800-271-63 or preparewithglenn.com. That's preparewithglenn.com. Welcome to the program. We have the story of Whitey. The press was very excited. Democrats were thrilled. Don Lemon was over the moon for about 10 minutes when he heard that Whitey was killed yesterday. And then he realized, oh, it's Whitey Bulger, the mob guy. Crap. But he was, did you hear how he was killed?
Was it the lock in a sock? Is that real?
Jeez. Apparently, I'm only familiar with, you know, shivving someone from my days and, you know, doing hard time. But apparently there is also another way to kill people, a lock in a sock. And when I asked what that was, I was told it's a lock in a sock. Mm-hmm. And then they swing it and hit you. Apparently.
It's an underrated Dr. Seuss book, I thought. It was a little violent for Seuss.
I will not kill him with a lock in a sock. Kill him! Kill him!
There's too many things that rhyme with sock that got big. It really got...
Okay, let's
it was
move
this
on
one
from here.
But X-rated...
Whitey Bulger's death and his life when we come back.
Glenn Beck is coming live to talk about the right path forward and to make fun of the people standing in the way. He might not be able to save the country, but at least we can all go down laughing. Glenn Beck Live, the Addicted to Outrage Tour. On tour this fall.
Glenn Beck.
Well, a lot of social justice warriors were excited when they heard that Whitey had died yesterday, but different Whitey. This was the mob guy. Whitey Bulger. He was 89 years old, found unresponsive yesterday at 8:20 in the morning. He had been in custody since Monday. They were transferring him. They moved him from a prison in Florida and had a stop in Oklahoma City before moving to West Virginia. He was attacked by three men in the general population sector of the prison. One of the men used a lock tucked into a sock as a weapon. It's a Dr. Seuss thing. I mean, it's a Halloween Dr. Seuss. We should write that. Anyway, and then the group attempted to gouge his eyes out. Okay, I mean, you know, why not? I'm John Johnson, but everyone around here likes to call me Nancy. So this guy is a notorious, by the way, the guy who killed him, what a surprise, a mob hitman. At least that's who they think. This guy's notorious, a legend in the mob world. Here's a clip from a documentary about him.
Whitey's just staring at me and just grinding his teeth. He said, I'll kill you. I'll stab you and then I'll kill you. I'm like, holy.
Whitey killed my sister, took her teeth out.
Whitey popped them and killed them.
Bulger asked if he wanted one in the head and shot him in the head.
He murdered people there. He buried people there. And he went to sleep there.
There were over 25 years where Bulger ruled the organized crime world. He was never charged with even a misdemeanor.
Whitey Bulger faces possible maximum life in prison.
This isn't really a typical criminal trial.
This is not about getting acquitted.
Don't you want to know what really went on?
Is the government excited about having Bulger come back? Some people certainly are, but there are others who have many sleepless nights about what James Bulger is going to testify to.
I asked the questions, I got the answers for money.
This is from a documentary, great documentary called Whitey, the United States of America versus James J. Bulger. The director is Joe Berlinger, and he's on with us now. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good to hear from you.
So for people who don't follow Whitey, tell his story.
It's a long and complicated tale, but in a nutshell, he ran South Boston, you know, a neighborhood called Southie, and over a 25-year period, he basically was allowed to kill with impunity. As we later found out, he was, allowed to be an informant for the FBI. The FBI's mandate in the 80s was to bring down the mafia. And to do that, they used Whitey and some of his associates as informants, and which in and of itself is okay, but they then turned a blind eye. You know, when you're an informant for the federal government, it's not a license to kill. He was allowed to basically run roughshod over the streets of South Boston. He had a strange hold over the neighborhood as well. There was a lot of folklore that he was like kind of a Robin Hood, you know, giving turkeys to family members and doing nice things for the neighborhood and keeping drugs out. But as the trial that is the subject of my documentary reveals, a lot of that was just myth. I mean, he was one of the biggest drug runners in the area. But he was, you know, the big unknown story that's not being talked about is, you know, he's often thought of as an informant. But his informing really didn't produce much, and in fact, he was really allowed to just, you know, create a lot of victims. So a lot of the victims of Bulger are still very angry with the federal government and the Department of Justice.
Who would the victims be?
Dozens of families who were the victims of Whitey's crimes. I mean, Whitey would...
Oh, I see what you're saying. But what? Did he put anybody behind bars? Did he rat out anybody that... In the end, did the government get anything?
That's open to debate.
Wow.
You know, the Boston Globe would tell you that, yes, he was a wonderful informant and that they broke the story. But there's evidence to suggest that it was a greater cover for just protecting Whitey, because with the federal authorities trying to crack down on the mob, on the Italian mafia, any hit on the mafia would have to run through Bulger's Winter Hill Gang, and some people feel and claim, and there was strong evidence to suggest, that the informing part was just a cover, and really they were allowing Whitey to live so that the then head of the strike force in New England to bring down the Italian mafia, a guy named Jeremiah T. O'Sullivan, was looking for a little quid pro quo, like, hey, Whitey, we'll let you do your thing as long as you make sure the mob doesn't kill me. Because there were incidents of lawyers and prosecutors getting killed in retaliation for bringing down the mob. So, you know, a lot of those allegations have not been proven, but his real connection to the information that he gave as being actually great and valid information is to me one of the myths of this case. We need much longer time period to really discuss it, but the documentary kind of delves into the how much free rein the guy was given. And again, if you're an informant for the government, it doesn't mean you can go out and commit crimes. It means you're working hand in hand with the government in exchange for some benefit, like not being prosecuted or a lesser sentence. It doesn't mean, oh, please go out and rob, kill, steal, and maim people. And there have been several civil suits brought against the Department of Justice that have not gone in the family's direction. Oh. And so there's still a lot of bitter feelings amongst the people who were victims of Bulger's crime, some of whom were, you know, criminals themselves, but that doesn't
yeah, it's still
the
murder.
The end doesn't justify the means.
Correct.
This guy for a quarter century was allowed to just kill with impunity. I mean, he was tipped off in advance about wiretaps. He was tipped off in advance about potential raids. Mm. So it's really a complicated, and in fact, some people believe that the 16 years he was on the lam, living in an apartment in Santa Monica with his girlfriend, Catherine Grieg, there are many, including myself, who believe that the government really wasn't looking very hard for him until a new regime came in, and then after 16 years, they decided to bring him to justice, and there was a trial in the summer of 2013.
So let's talk a little bit about the first myth that you talked about, that he was known as a good guy in the neighborhood. Isn't that, I mean, this is my impression, and maybe I'm wrong on this. Isn't that kind of the thing with, you know, Al Capone tried to do that, and, you know, people like to think that, oh, no, these guys are just, you know, they're whacking just the bad guys. They're actually good family men. You know, there was a day when you would kill a man and then you'd send his wife flowers.
Yeah.
Is any of that true?
That seems to be the case. That he also did some very good things as well, you know, at times, but for some people. And also, for example, there was a big busing crisis in South Boston. You know, there was an attempt to desegregate, and there was a busing order issued. And Whitey actually was very vociferous, in campaigning against it, and that kind of rallied South Boston residents to him.
He was a good guy, but because, I mean, that helped create cover for him and goodwill.
Yeah, exactly. And his brother was a famous politician, so there was a lot of confusion there as well, you know, with, Bill Bulger, president of University of Massachusetts and a prominent politician. So there was a lot of messy gray areas there with the Bulger
family. So was he involved? Was he just the guy saying, yeah, whack him? Or was he involved in the killings?
Oh, he took pleasure in being involved in the killings. And, you know, his signature, because back then there was no DNA evidence, his signature was removing teeth of his victims, so that they couldn't be identified. But no, he was a willing and ruthless participant in some very grisly murders.
And there was a
neighborhood house that they had called the Haunty, where a number of these victims were buried in the dirt basement of the actual house that they used as a meeting place. So there's just a lot of grisly detail with this case, but. I mean, the fascinating thing is after 16 years on the lam, they finally caught him in Santa Monica, living quiet, you know, living a quiet life, retiree's life. You know, he had almost $900,000 in cash and stuck in the walls and a coterie of machine guns and weapons, but living just a quiet life. And when he's finally caught and brought back to Boston for trial, you know, he offered to plead guilty in exchange for, this is another, I've been looking at some of the notices, and these are some of the things that have been left out. You know, he offered to plead guilty if they would take it easy on his girlfriend, his live-in girlfriend, Catherine Grieg, who joined him for the 16 years of being on the run. He was willing to plead guilty if they would take it easy on her and give her some very light treatment, and the government refused. And you have to ask yourself, why did we go through a multi-million dollar trial for Whitey Bulger when the conclusion was foregone at the start mm-hmm. of that trial? Nobody thought he would be found not guilty. I mean, the evidence was just overwhelming. And it probably would have saved the state quite a bit of money to not try him, but they didn't take it easy on him.
How'd they catch him? How'd they catch him?
There was, you know, they decided to focus on the girlfriend, and they placed some advertisements, and a woman, you know, noticed not Whitey, but the girlfriend, and called it in and got a nice reward for that.
So wait, so they prosecuted the woman who turned him in?
No, not the woman who turned him in.
Oh, another, okay, another woman, not the girlfriend, another woman.
Correct.
Turned him in, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Now, he was killed yesterday. I mean, besides Dr. Seuss, I didn't know who would come up with a lock in a sock. But he apparently was killed by a guy they think is, or they, I should say this, there's a guy in prison who was a mob hitman who they think killed him. They know he was a mob hitman. Was everybody against this guy? I mean, was he marked for death as soon as they could kill him?
I don't have the details of yesterday, and it's, you know, it's hard to say, but, you know, he is responsible for helping or, you know, bring down the Italian mafia. So you would imagine that there would be people who would be out for his death. And you have to question, you know, the security, and you know, it's still unclear to me. I'm still trying to get some information as to why he was being moved and why the multiple moves and why the lack of security. You know, some people are speculating that this was a purposeful move. I can't say that, but you know, a guy who's involved in multiple murders over decades and involved in bringing down the mafia, you know, would you know, be a target.
We're talking to Joe Berlinger. He is the director of Whitey, United States of America versus James J. Bulger, who is, you know, Whitey. I guess, what was it that attracted you to this story? Why did you make the film, and what attracted you to it, and what did you take away from it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that, you know, Bulger finally being brought to trial, because there's such a myth about the guy, there's such folklore, you know, in our society. Unfortunately, we tend to glamorize, mm-hmm. make heroes out of criminals. Bulger probably is the greatest example of that. So much folklore surrounding him, so much hero worship, films that kind of downplay the grisly side of, or the aftermath of what he's responsible for, even if it does show the details of how people are killed. You know, we celebrate criminals in this society, mm-hmm. which is an odd phenomenon. And so the idea that he was being brought back to trial, finally, to face the music, I thought would be a great opportunity to kind of separate fact from fiction and to really understand the crimes. That was my going in assumption, but sitting through that trial and witnessing it and getting to know Bulger, in fact, I was the only journalist allowed to actually interview him, because the defense attorneys basically trusted me versus some other journalists, in part because of my previous work, films like Paradise Lost. You know, what fascinated me and what my big turn was just how culpable the government has been in allowing a killer to run roughshod over the streets of Boston, and how, you know, his informant, you know, if you're going to allow somebody to evade justice for 25 years, you would hope that the record of
what you got out
of him is so rock solid and so points to, like, oh my God, this guy was invaluable. But the evidence was just not there for me. You know, he was in the logbooks as being an informant. But you know, if you really drill into it, there's very little information he gave that the feds didn't already have. And so then the question is, why was he allowed? I mean, even if he gave the best information on the planet, and he's directly responsible for the end of the mafia in New England as we know it, which was not the case, you still have to question the wisdom of the government allowing somebody like that to commit murder, and they knew it.
Joe, multiple
times.
Thank you very much. And if you want to see the video, you can. Check it out online and watch it out. It's got kind of a weird Halloween kind of movie to check out. Thank you, Joe, very much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
The movie is Whitey, United States of America versus James J. Bulger. You can check it out online as well as you get iTunes and everything. He's at Joe Berlinger on Twitter.
All right, let me tell you a little bit about selling your house. If you want to sell your house, you need the, you know, you need the person that's going to do the best job, that has a record. I mean, you're going to buy chicken, you know, you go to the guy who's got the 11 herbs and secret herbs and spices, right?
Sure.
Why has he sold so much chicken? He knows what he's doing. That's why. That's the same thing with a real estate agent. A lot of real estate agents are part-time real estate. I do that on the side. Don't do that person. Don't. They're not going to sell your house. You need somebody that is the right agent, that knows your area, knows how much it's worth, has the right advertising and publicity schedule. Somebody who knows how to bring a ton of buyers in to see your house, at least online. Now, we have about 1,500 agents all over America. Their word is their bond. They're fans of the show. They share your sensibilities. These are people that we have vetted, handpicked for the team, for their knowledge, their skill, and their track record in your area. If you need to sell your home, call us. Get in touch with realestateagentsitrust.com. Do it first. Realestateagentsitrust.com. Sell your home on time and for the most amount of money. Realestateagentsitrust.com. We have an election update coming up in just a few minutes that you don't want to miss. We also have one of the candidates, GOP candidates, running. We're going to talk to him. Also, I want to give you this real quick, because the press keeps saying that, you know, George Soros, they're saying that Jewish money was behind the last caravan. Well, let me just give you the facts. Soros money behind the 2018 caravan. We did a whole episode on this, and you can... You know, the press can poke fun, but these are the facts. BuzzFeed News was listed as on-the-ground coordinator for the caravan named Alex Mensing. Alex works for a group called CARA, C-A-R-A. It's an umbrella organization that includes two organizations, the Catholic Legal Immigration Network and the American Immigration Society. Both organizations within CARA receive funding from George Soros. Catholic League Immigration Network as early as 2009, tax returns in as late as 2015 showed the annual funding had gone from $500,000 in 2009 to $970,000 in 2015. That was the latest tax record that we could find. Tax returns from 2015 also show funding from George Soros to the American Immigration Society, a check for $350,000. So is George Soros directing this? No, we didn't say that. We said George Soros money was behind this. He helped fund it. These organizations are getting money directly from him. They were the ones that were funding and behind the caravan in 2018. That's the truth, and it has nothing to do with whether you go to a mosque, a synagogue, or a church. It has everything to do with your politics and money. Well, next week is the election. Stu's got some election by the numbers coming up for us in just a minute, but we wanted to... We wanted to introduce you to somebody in Mississippi that is, I think, a great state senator, Chris McDaniel. He is running for U.S. Senate. However, it is a different kind of system in Mississippi. This is a three-way race, or I don't know how many people are actually involved, but the top two are going to have a runoff again. So he just needs to make it into the top two, and he could be the next Senate. Or senator for the United States out of Mississippi. As a state senator since 2008, he has written and sponsored a ton of legislation in Mississippi. He has fought for private property rights, restrict the use of eminent domain, the Student Religious Liberties Act he authored and passed into law to protect the rights of students to pray in school. He introduced the Firearms Freedom Protection Act to protect against federal encroachment on Second Amendment rights, fought against government paternalism by sponsoring legislation to allow citizens opt-out requirements to provide personal and private information in the use of a government database. He is now running for the Senate in Mississippi. His name is Chris McDaniel. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you, Glenn. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Good. So tell me why people should vote for you in Mississippi.
Well, I'm the only lifetime Republican in this race, the only conservative in this race. My record demonstrates that. I've been fighting these fights my entire life. You might remember back in 2014, we ran against Senator Cochran. Mm-hmm. He was a 41-year incumbent, and we defeated him the first night with 49.7% of the vote. He then recruits 40,000 Democrats to come into a GOP primary, and they beat us by 1% going down the stretch. We're back in that same fight. This is a seat we feel like we rightfully won in 2014. The establishment stole this seat, and now we want this seat back. I'm the conservative, and I'm ready to fight Washington, D.C.
So what does it mean to be a conservative now, Chris?
Well, from my perspective, it means the same thing it always says. I'm a Taft, Jeffersonian, Reagan, Goldwater conservative. And what that means essentially is we demand limited governments. We demand individual responsibility. We demand liberty. We have to trend toward liberty in everything that we do. At some point along the way in this country, we abdicated our responsibility for self-government. We gave it over to the federal government. It's time to reclaim that authority. So in everything that we do, we're empowering individuals, not the collective. We're putting people on pedestals, not politicians. That's what it means to be a conservative.
All right. So tell me just a few things where you stand. What'd you think of Kavanaugh?
I liked him. I still like him. I thought he was abused by the Democrats. I thought he should have been confirmed much sooner than he was. The evidence that I saw was not substantiated. There was absolutely no proof that he committed any act. If that's the case, under our due process standards, he is presumed innocent. The burden was on her, not him. He didn't have to prove his innocence to us. She had to prove his guilt. She couldn't do that. So I thought what the Democrats put his family through was an absolute nightmare. He should have been confirmed much sooner.
What do you think we should do with the caravan if it makes it to our border?
They can't be allowed to enter, period. That's just the bottom line. We're a nation of laws, and a nation that cannot defend its borders cannot be called a sovereign nation. These individuals cannot be allowed to enter this country, period.
So what do you do?
The combination of several things. If you have to use the military, you use the military. But also, I would like to see if we couldn't get Mexico involved. I'm tired of Mexico being the corrupt state that it is, failing to take action and allowing these people to go across their soil to get to our border. I mean, after all, Mexico depends on us to prop up their economy, not only through trade, but also through some direct subsidies. They should take some responsibility in stopping these people. But if they can't stop the individuals, if we have to use the American military, we certainly will.
Birthright citizenship. Is that what the Constitution says? Should this be a Supreme Court decision? Should there be an amendment? And second question, can the president do that by executive order?
Here's the thing. The birthright citizenship is absolutely not intended for children of ambassadors. It's not intended for children of foreigners in this country. That was never the case. So I can say unequivocally that when it comes to illegal aliens, there should never be a birthright citizenship. If you listen or read the ratification debate around the amendment, the author made it very clear that was the case. And so basically we're operating under a misconception or a misinterpretation of the amendment. That being said, the preferred approach is for Congress to simply clarify under the 14th Amendment what that clause means, and Congress certainly has that power. It's empowered by the amendment itself. I think it's good to be having this conversation. At the very least, hopefully we can get a firm decision on it somewhere about what it actually means. But in my position, the way the original Constitution was framed, absolutely not. Birthright citizenship does not apply to illegal aliens. And I think if you heard the other night some great legal analysis on that, I fall with the originalists, no question.
Tell me what it means to be conservative when the conservatives in Washington are spending faster than the Democrats were under Obama.
It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing, Glenn. I mean, I signed up for a party that was fiscally disciplined, a party that calls for balanced budgets and fiscal austerity. And now we're going to basically add $1 trillion to the national debt this year. And it's a nightmare. And that falls directly on the backs of Congress, particularly Mitch McConnell. There's no justification for the Republican Party being in control of this government and still funding Planned Parenthood, still funding sanctuary cities, still funding Obamacare and not a dime for a border wall. The system is broken, and that begins right there in the office of Mitch McConnell, and things have to change. So listen, I'm tired of our party giving lip service to conservatism, giving lip service to fiscal discipline, and then breaking the bank. I've got two kids at home, a six-year-old and an 11-year-old. They deserve a country like the one I inherited. We can't give that to them if we're being completely undisciplined with our fiscal affairs.
Chris, if people want to get involved, where do they go?
McDaniel2018.com. We'd love to have your help. McDaniel2018.com.
Thank you so much, Chris. Best of luck to you next week. God bless.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Interesting race. I don't know if I like the system there, where it's three candidates and the top two go on. I do like the main system of the ranked choice voting, which it makes it a lot easier, where you do it all at once. You don't have to have a whole separate election, because that's what happened to Chris last time. I mean, he won the original election, and then they had to go on to this runoff because he missed by 0.3%. And then, Thad Cochran just went to all the Democrats and said, hey, come over here.
Crazy.
Yeah, it really was.
Crazy.
Brutal.
I remember that race and being very, very upset. It was just a miscarriage of justice, I thought. But all right, our sponsor this half hour is Liberty Safe, number one safe manufacturer in the nation. They have sold over 2 million safes, and they've sold them for a reason. Liberty Safe leads the industry in technology and innovation. They have military-style locking bars. They have heat-expanding fire seals, which is so amazing. You see these houses. Did I send you that documentary on the wildfire in Santa Rosa?
I don't think so.
Oh, you know Michael O'Shea, my friend,
yeah.
Michael O'Shea? He owns a local radio station in Santa Rosa. I wish I would have known this at the time. And his all cell phones, the towers melted, everything went out. Oh. Only AM radio was available.
Wow.
And so they were telling everybody where to go. And the wildfires in California happen so rapidly.
Yeah.
Starts at 11 o'clock. By 4 o'clock in the morning, gone. Everything's just gone. Mm. 3,000 degrees. Anyway, you see these pictures of these wildfires, and there will be nothing left, literally nothing left, except the chimney and the Liberty Safe. And you open these things up and they still have all your valuables in them and they're all safe. It's truly remarkable. So whether you want to protect from thieves or from fire, you want to keep your family safe by securing your guns, prescription medication, now is the time to have a Liberty Safe. Become a Liberty Safe owner like I am. They offer a 12-month interest-free financing on approved credit. LibertySafe.com. Go there now. LibertySafe.com. Man, this is getting some great email. Thank you so much for writing. I wish I could respond to everybody, but I read your email. Listen to this one. Glenn, I was listening to your interview this week with the Red Pill, and I really found myself moved. They don't want me to identify. So let me just say that they are they're somebody who knows something about publishing. And children publishing. There are conferences where editors have said point blank what happens when they come across a manuscript they love. The first thing they do is check the author's Facebook page. If they see a conservative content, they throw the manuscript away. This isn't limited just to political issues. The book could be about the life cycle of trees. But as another editor agreed, they don't want to build the career of somebody who might write a conservative idea saying, quote, we don't want to give these voices an audience with children. I've heard these agents say that if your young adult novel doesn't include gay sex or an orgy, they don't even want to see it. Keep in mind, YA books are marketed to children as young as 12. Middle grade and picture books are just fraught with propaganda. Dear friend of mine had a middle grade novel published that reveals Donald Trump and explains to children why they should fear and hate him. It's called Unprecedented. Anyway, I know you're such an incredible optimist, but I wanted to let you know how publishing is trying to lock up the next generation. I am very, very, very well aware of what is happening in publishing. The book that I wrote took about a year and a half just to convince them to publish it. It's an interesting time that we live in. Got this in. Glenn, I'm going to see your Hershey show. This is on Friday. We're going to be in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Tomorrow night, we're in Richmond, Virginia. Don't miss it. Richmond, Virginia, then Hershey, Pennsylvania on Friday. On Saturday, we're going to be in Pittsburgh, and on Sunday in Cleveland, Ohio.
It's still accurate that only bad people will miss it? Is that still true?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It is.
That is confirmed.
Terrorists.
Okay.
Terrorists.
Only people terrorists will miss it?
Yes, okay. Only terrorists. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to your Hershey show. I'm bringing my wife as part of her birthday present. I have to tell you, she's not very enthusiastic. For my birthday, she took me to see Jay Leno. I'm taking her to see you.
Wow.
It's not that she has anything against you. She just hates political talk shows. But I told her how you bring morality, doing the right thing, do unto others into your discussions, and that she, as the most moral and selfless person I've ever known, will really enjoy the evening. So please, please help me out. My part. I'm going to take her out to dinner before the show, and I'm going to pump a lot of Chardonnay into her.
Amen.
Your job, be funny, but also have some of those moments where you use that low, soft storytelling voice that you have. Kind of sounds like Jim Nance when he's calling the final putt on the 18th green. You know, that voice that you use, very soft and breathy. If you got it in you, get a little weepy, too, because chicks dig that.
I love this guy.
I do, too. I'm not going to give you his name, but... Oh, Ed, we've now just we have. I just read this before we went on the air to Stu, and we are going to do something very special for you and your wife.
Oh, yes.
So you don't want to miss that. Let's see. There was another one that I got in about. By the way, you can get your tickets at glenbeck.com/tour. There's another one I got in about Honduras. Listen to this. Glenn, I live in Honduras, and I love what you're saying because you're the only one that's saying it. I want you to know that when you talked about Venezuela being the funding, please understand it's impossible that all of the funding that is happening and still is happening could come from Venezuela and Honduras. I've got to be careful on reading this, too. Let's see. A friend was very pleased because on Saturday they went to the big bus company that goes from someplace in Honduras to Guatemala. When they arrived, each adult was given 1,000 lempira, and their son, underage, was given 500 lempira to help them make the trip to the U.S. These are Libre operatives. That's who's giving them the money. This wasn't 3 weeks ago, Glenn. This was last Saturday. They're still trying to push people into the U.S. They're rewarding them for civil disobedience and rewarding them for breaking the law. I know a couple of people. I'm just sorry. I have to be very careful because this person could be in danger. They tell me if they are figured out.
These moments like this person's life is in Glenn's hands right now.
And would you feel comfortable?
Oh, my gosh. No. It's like when you start talking about a movie, you're like, I'm not going to give anything away. But I'm like, oh, no.
They all die in the end.
Yeah, right.
Okay. The only movie I didn't destroy was Titanic. That was the only one.
Well, that's everyone knows that story already.
Exactly right. That's why I was feel comfortable. Except the witch threw the. I mean, who throws that into the.
Spoiler alert.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. So anyway, one of the guys that is in this caravan is a corrupt cop who used to move drugs and was kicked out of the Honduran police. There are criminals and gang members in this group. I can't tell you why this man knows it, but he does.
I found it very interesting talking about the caravan, how many people have said, well, if you are saying George Soros is funding the caravan, you're an anti-Semite. And like we have not said that George Soros is
not
funding this caravan.
Nope.
But we have talked about the evidence behind his organization's funding of the previous caravan,
yes.
Which it could very easily be why this is all being conflated. And the idea that, you know, that they would not even acknowledge, okay, well, yeah, sure, he funded the last one, but it's anti-Semitic to think he's funding this one. Look, it's wrong to think he's funding this one until we have evidence.
Yeah,
we don't know who's doing it right now. The vice president
has said, and we have this also, I think, from the governor of Texas. Didn't he allude to this as well?
That it
was coming from internal sources, and Vice President said Venezuela. It makes sense. That's what we have found, but we don't have a smoking gun. I have nothing that says that George Soros funded this. However, we may have an update on that later this week, but nothing so far. And by the way, why is CNN saying it's not Soros
Glenn
money, but
Beck
Jewish money?
Mercury.
Glenn Beck is coming live to talk about the right path forward and to make fun of the people standing in the way. He might not be able to save the country, but at least we can all go down laughing. Glenn Beck Live, the Addicted to Outrage Tour, on tour this fall.
Glenn Beck.
Hey, Stu, what's the date today?
It's October 31st, Glenn.
Which is?
Currently Halloween, unless
it's
changed.
Currently Halloween. Yes. Currently. It's always October 31st.
It is.
And October 31st, what do we do? Besides get fat with candy.
Well, that's the main thing. But also, we play the Telltale Heart, because that it's a Halloween tradition. And people love it. We always hear about people when they're trick-or-treating at the house. When they have people coming to the house to trick-or-treat, they play it on speakers by the house. Telltale Heart. Yeah, very cool.
You can get it on iTunes and everything else. Lots of Edgar Allan Poe this year. Just the Telltale Heart.
It's Wednesday, October 31st. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
It was a crime of contempt. One young man's logic misguided through the onslaught of insanity. His name remains unspoken, but his crime is unforgettable. This is his story.
True. Nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous. I had been and am. But why would you say that I'm mad? The disease sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them.
Above all, the sense of hearing was acute. I heard all things in heaven and in hell. Oh, I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It's impossible to say how the first idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object, there was none. Passion, there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes. It was this. He had an eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so, by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man, and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a lantern, dark, all closed, so no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it in slowly, very, very slowly, so I may not disturb the old man's sleep. Oh, it took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening, so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have done something as wise as this? And then, when my head was well within the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I did it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed, so it was impossible to do the work. It was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he had passed the night. So, you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in on him while he slept. Upon the eighth night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that I was there, opening the door little by little, and he not even dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly as if startled. Now, you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was black as pitch with thick darkness, for the shutters were closed and fastened through the fear of robbers. And so I knew he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on. Steadily. Steadily. I had my head in. I was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in the bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quiet, still. I said nothing. For a whole hour, I did not move a muscle. And in the meantime, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in bed, listening, just as I had done night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently, I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief, oh no. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it had welled up from my own bosom, deepening with a dreadful echo. The terrors that distracted me, oh, I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt and pitied him. Although I chuckled at heart, I knew that he had been laying awake ever since the first slight noise when he turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It's nothing but the wind in the chimney. It's only a mouse crossing the floor." Or, "It's merely a cricket who's made a single chirp." Oh, yes. He had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions. But he found them all in vain. All in vain. Because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he never saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a very long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. Oh, you cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a single dim ray, like the thread of a spider, shot from the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was open. It was wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, a dull blue with a hideous veil over that chilled my very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but an over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates a soldier into courage. But even yet,
I refrained. I kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder. I say louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I told you that I was nervous, and so I am. And now, at the dead hour of night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet, for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder and louder. I thought his heart must burst. And then a new anxiety seized me. The sound. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once. Only once. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. Then I smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, his heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, didn't vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hands upon the heart. I felt it for many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned. I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. Then I took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. Then I replaced the boards so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot whatever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught it all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what now do I have to fear? There entered 3 men who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search. Search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from your fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner convinced them. I was simply at ease. They sat while I answered cheerily. They chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting paled and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct.
I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definitiveness until, at length, I found that the noise was not within my ears. Now, no doubt I grew very pale, but I talked more frequently and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased. What could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound. Much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles, a high key, with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair in which I had been sitting and grated it across the boards, but the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder and louder and louder, and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no. No, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now again, hark, hark, louder and louder and louder. Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here. Here is the beating of his hideous heart.
I read that to my daughter's third grade class. The first year I did it. The teacher was horrified. Wait, you're reading what? I like, my kids love it. No, yeah, the rest of the kids really didn't. But anyway, it's been a tradition on this program, and you can get it on iTunes, and we're going to send it out in social and share it with a friend. All right. Let me tell you a little bit about Relief Factor. Relief Factor has been helping the people here at The Blaze and a lot of our listeners and viewers alleviate pain for about 4 years. I've had a rough bout with pain over the last few years. And, you know, I went to the doctor, and I'm a guy. I've woken up on the operating table. It takes a lot to dull me and to put me under. So when it comes to, you know, 100% drug free, yeah, it ain't gonna work. So I didn't really try it. Well, I ran out of patience. I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take the pain, and I don't want to take the medicine from the doctor. I think that crap is poison. So my wife said, hey, you know, before you, you know, like off yourself, what do you say we try Relief Factor? So I did. I tried it for 3 weeks because that's what they say. Try it for 3 weeks. Well, 70% of the people who try it for 3 weeks order month after month after month. And I'm one of them. I'm telling you, it was created by doctors and it is a lifesaver, at least for me. It has these ingredients. They're all natural, but it helps reduce the inflammation in our body. And that's where a lot of our pain comes from. So Relief Factor, go there now. Try it. It's what, $19, $20, and you can have it for 3 weeks. If it works, you have your life back. ReliefFactor.com. ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. ReliefFactor.com. I'm just reviewing all of the scripts from the four-part series that I did years ago called The Puppet Master, George Soros. Because for some reason, George Soros is being rehabilitated again in the press. And now they're taking it so far by saying that people are saying this caravan is now being funded with Jewish money. And when they say Jewish money, what they're actually saying is George Soros. They're saying that people said that George Soros has funded this. But to make it sound more anti-Semitic, they're saying people are claiming that this is now being funded with Jewish money. So who's the anti-Semite here? Who's the one lying? First of all, this caravan, we have absolutely no evidence that George Soros is involved in this or any of his money is going to fund or support any of this. We have zero information. We do have information that two of the organizations that he helps fund were directly responsible for the last caravan in April. But probably next week, we're going to go through the puppet master and I'll bring you the absolute facts, because the media has gone insane, just insane. They don't even know how to describe a mob. They can't call a group of people clad in black, covering their faces, walking through the streets with sticks, breaking glass, you know, storefronts. I mean, that's Kristallnacht. They can't even call those people a mob. So it comes to us to set the record straight. We'll do that next week on George Soros.
Mercury.
If I could convince the president of one thing, I think it wouldn't have anything to do with Twitter. It would have everything to do with, please, Mr. President, please recognize that the trade barriers are causing a problem. If you lose with the trade barriers, if the economy slides into the abyss because of this trade war, you're done. Please, please stop with the trade war. The new research that is out shows that all of the gains from the tax cuts, almost all of it now has been lost because of the effects of the trade war. It's not even helping the steel industry anymore. This is really detrimental to the economy.
Yeah, Jim Cramer, who was a supporter of the tariffs against China in particular, came out yesterday with a full sort of mea culpa. Said, look, you know, I thought, yes, we'd feel a little bit of pain from this, but it would at least help the steel companies. And, you know, China's a bad actor. And I'm glad, you know, that we're doing something about it. He's like, the evidence clearly shows that this is not only not working, but not even helping the steel companies. Steel companies are even still getting hit through this because, there's retribution. There's other tax back at us because of the tariffs. It's really hurting the progress of the economy and has turned back. I mean, this is the headliner from Business Insider yesterday. Trump's tax law sent stocks soaring. Again, like, they're not bashing Trump here. They're saying his tax law was a really good idea, and it you know, sent the economy soaring. But now his trade war is hurting the market's biggest driver and threatening to erase all of his progress. Wall Street Journal they talked about a study yesterday, they analyzed data from 151 nations between 1963 and 2014, looking for what occurred when tariffs rose by about 3.6 percentage points, small potatoes compared with tariffs in the U.S. That were imposing on China for steel producing and such. Study didn't take account of other trade restrictions, including non-tariff barriers and retaliatory tariffs. The result? Slower growth, more unemployment, higher inequality, exchange rate appreciation, and no improvement in the trade balance, which President Trump has said is his main measure of U.S. trade health. Now, I don't care about the trade balance at all. It doesn't actually do anything bad for the economy. But still, if you do care about it, it's not even working for that. And we've seen, since these things have started, the trade imbalance has continued to increase, not decrease, but increase. So it's not even working for the problems that I don't even think are problems. So it really is. I would agree with you. I mean, there are a lot of things I think to like about this presidency so far, and we've mentioned them many, many times. Some things we don't like, but I mean, the free trade thing is the worst part of it. It's his single worst policy. It's the one thing he's completely convinced is right, and it's doing real damage to the economy and to American workers, the ones who elected him.
The problem with this is people, they hear China, and they're right. They hear China, and they're like, you know what? The Chinese are screwing us. The Chinese are not screwing us in the trade imbalance. The Chinese are screwing us with their cyber ops.
Oh, yeah.
They are stealing so much from us. I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to find this. I'm reading this great book called Future Crimes, Everything Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Should Do About It. And it talks about China and how it's an ungodly high number of hacks on the Pentagon last year. They're constantly hacking in to our Pentagon, the government servers. It's like 90,000 hacks on the government last year from China. It's staggering, and nobody's talking about it. They just got into a deal a few years back with a wind generator firm that was making these giant generators that you put on a, you know, on a windmill, and they had a 490, I want to say billion dollar, but it can't be, $490 million bid. And they had all of these turbines being built by this company, and it was like $490,000, $490 million over like 5 years. Well, the company shipped out the first turbine, but the company was told by China, "Hey, we need to see everything. We need to know every step of the way what's going on." What they did is they got access to the servers. They hacked in. They downloaded everything. They got one generator. Then they canceled. They said, "Yeah, we're good." Well, they found out that China had hacked in, got all of the blueprints, everything they had. They had one that they that was made by Americans, and they brought it into their factories and said, "Okay, just make a bunch of these." That's what they're doing to us all the time.
It's amazing.
That's not a trade problem.
That's not a trade problem. I mean, depending on what information you're accessing, it's an act of war. I mean, it can be.
They have accessed our power grid. They have accessed. I mean, I'm telling you, if we ever go to war, it's going to be lights out. These China and Russia, this is what, well, Putin said, World War III will be fought with ones and zeros, not bombs. And China is doing the same exact thing.
So why don't we do more about this?
I think probably because we owe China so much money. Nobody wants to make an enemy of China. Nobody wants to say anything. We probably do some of this stuff, not stealing things, but I'm sure we are trying to hack into their military as well. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, everybody's listening to each other.
Right.
You know, so let's not talk about it. We'll all deny it, but we all know. But China is a different animal. China is the wealth, the largest transfer of wealth in human history has happened in the last 10 years. And it's all theft from China. What they have stole from our corporations, the plans, the ideas, what they have taken from our corporations and our country is the largest transfer of wealth in human history. And it's all ill-gotten goods.
Wow. So that's separate from their rules. Like, so China has very restrictive rules in their country, and these are non-tariff barriers in my mind, which basically say, hey, you want access to our, you know, 1.5 billion people? You want access to this market? What you're going to have to do when you come over here is give us access to your technology. And willingly, corporations do this all the time. They go over there and they say, well, I mean, I want to have access to this market, so I guess you can have it. Now, that's a terrible policy.
But that's
China,
by choice.
But it's also companies choosing to do it. That's different.
This is theft. This is them getting in, like the wind turbines, okay? Getting in, having basic access. Okay, we're going to buy these. We'll buy them for $470 million, whatever it is. We'll buy those. Yeah, it's great. Send them over to us, but we need access. You know, we need to be able to see anything. Then going in beyond the access that they said and grabbing everything.
That's amazing.
It's crazy. It is so bad. And, you know, people, one of these days, are just going to wake up. 2020. Next year, in just a few months, it'll be 2019. In 2020. Their total surveillance state they'll turn the key for the entire country. That's what, 15 months away.
Do we have the audio? I know we pulled it for one day this week of the Chinese train.
Oh, it's terrifying.
Sarah, I don't know if we can dig that up. I think it was yesterday.
There's a train. It's a high speed train. And you're hearing over the loudspeakers, you're hearing in Chinese a announcement that says basically.
It's not in Chinese, though.
Was it in English?
It's in English, yeah.
Okay. And it's basically saying, don't break any of the rules. Hand your tickets when you're asked. Do exactly as you're told. Otherwise, you'll lose points and
social credit.
In
right?
Social credit.
Like, and they're talking about this system, which, if you've seen Black Mirror, I swear, Black Mirror has to be based on this real system being built in China.
Oh, yeah.
But there's an episode where, you know, you go up every interaction you have, you essentially get rated. And if you do things that are wrong, your star rating lowers and you can't get access to things. You might not be able to get on a plane or might not be able to go to a fancy restaurant or whatever it is. They're actually building this in China. It's already in effect in some places. There's already a skeleton in effect of it.
And they already in Beijing, they have three concentric circles. And the inner circle, which is the main city. And how many, can you look up real quick? How many people live in Beijing proper, the actual city? The inner circle is the actual city. They gave an operative, I think a couple of hours head start and said, go into the inner circle, hide. They gave him 2 hours. They then said, to the security service, here's a picture of the guy you're looking for. Feed it into the system. Find him.
Jeez.
In 8 minutes, they didn't just find him. In 8 minutes, he was in the back of a squad car. That's 24 million people. In 8 minutes, they found one.
Incredible.
That's what's coming. That's the kind of surveillance that China has developed. This is not some futuristic thing. It's here. All it takes is a country that needs to be monitored that way. The really truly frightening thing, I've been doing a lot of reading on communism and fascism of World War II recently, and I was shocked at how many countries were fascist by choice, not taken over. They were fascist by choice. There were only about three or four of them that were fascist by choice in the 1920s. But there's like 15 before 1938. It all happens between 1930 and 1940. That's when the world went fascist and communist. What happened in the world in 1930? Depression. When you have a we-centered, these people are bad, these people are good, and we're right, they're wrong, we've got to get it. If this economy falls apart and we haven't found our way to each other, the world's history will repeat. We just have to find our way to each other. And it's really not that hard if we start concentrating on the things that actually matter. And they're big things that are coming down the pike. And I will tell you, communism and fascism, they failed because you could short circuit the system. Unless you hit the world with an EMP, you aren't short circuiting total control. We are building a system happily that in China is now being turned into a giant prison camp where you can't do anything. I was told by a friend, if you go to Beijing and you want to pretty much make sure you're not being filmed, turn the lights off in your bathroom and get into the shower, and perhaps you're not being seen or heard. No thanks. I can't believe that system is 15 months away. I mean, it's already happening in many places in China, but the full system goes online in 15 months. Can you imagine what that would feel like as a citizen knowing, oh, crap, I've got 15 months to get the hell out of here? SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is a system that will keep you safe through monitoring of your home. But unlike the Five Eyes kind of situation or Sharp Eyes system that China has, SimpliSafe knew. They really pay attention to detail. They knew because they think like you do. I don't want a camera that I don't know if it's on or off. And so usually there'll be a camera and they'll have a little red light that goes on. Well, do you know that's off for sure? Really? Peace of mind means a lot to these people. And so what they did is they spent about another year and a half developing exactly the right thing. It's the right kind of metal, the right thickness. The parts won't wear out. I mean, they're really a year and a half just to put a little lens cap on that thing. So when you turn the cameras on, zoop, you hear it zoop, click back. When you turn them off, zoop, and it locks off. And so the camera lens is covered. Who thinks of that? People who think like you do, people who have it in their house. And they're like, I don't know if I feel comfortable with that. SimpliSafe. You're going to save a buttload of money. It's the best security system out there. SimpliSafeBeck.com. You can save 10% right now. SimpliSafeBeck.com. You excited? Tomorrow is our beginning of our tour.
I am.
I actually am, too. I've been really concerned because I haven't been on tour in a very long time, and I can't wait to see. I wish I could just come over to your house. You know what I mean? I just wish we could.
Yeah, I'm not available right now.
Not your house.
We're a bug bomb.
You've got a bunch of vegetarian crap at your house. I mean, if you're a meat eater and you have ice cream, I would like to just come over to your house. Anyway, but we're doing the tour, and it starts tomorrow, and it is beginning in Richmond, Virginia. We have somebody, Charles, Virginia. He's been holding for a while. He says we need to go to Buzz and Ned's Barbecue. I mean, is it a dive? Because we're looking for good bad food. You know what I mean? Not fine.
It's a barbecue.
Go ahead.
It's a barbecue joint. It's been there for. They've been in town for 30 years. The newer one is on West Broad, and right up the street from West Broad, there's a donut shop called Country Style Donuts.
Oh, you have me at donut shop.
You walk in there, and they have like honey buns as big as your head. They have eclairs.
Okay, hold on. I need to get that information. This deserves a signed autograph book for you, by the way, Charles. hang on just a sec, because we're going to be in Richmond tomorrow, then Hershey, Pennsylvania. Ooh, Hershey. And then Pittsburgh on Saturday and Cleveland on Sunday. Tickets available right now, glennbeck.com/tour.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.